Okay. Truth, right? So, we're going to talk about marriage today, but not so much about how to communicate, more about the philosophy of it, but I wanted you to be in a good mood, so that's why we showed that video. We're going to be picking back up in our study today in the Gospel of Matthew, and if you've got a way of following along and would like to, if you'll head over to Matthew chapter 19, please. Last week, as we finished up chapter 18, Jesus was instructing us on how to interact with each other socially as the church. And he talked about our willingness to forgive as being a vital component for how it is that we go about approaching community together. And now today, Matthew groups another section with this and draws the circle closer in. And he talks about the marriage relationship. And he talks about divorce as well. And actually, that's the primary topic of this section. This is my second time teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. And I'm not going to necessarily approach this topic the way in a very straightforward way or linger on it like I did the last time around. In fact, I went back and listened. It's one of those rare times. I actually liked the teaching I did on that back then. And so if you want a more in-depth examination of the subject matter of divorce, then I'm going to point you to that teaching. It's online. I've linked to it on Wonder What. It's under our archived audio teachings on our website at eastgatefellowship.net. If you're really interested, you can listen to the teaching that I did on the parallel passage in Mark chapter 10, which even goes more in depth into the whole thing. But again, those are online. You can listen to them at your convenience. Today, I want to draw out what we learned from the other side of what it is that Jesus is talking about. I want to actually focus on the marriage part of this, what the original intent is for marriage, and what it means, and why it's worth working for, and how sometimes the reality is it's not even going to be a part of someone's experience in some people's cases. It's an interesting section to look at. Nothing to be nervous of. Easy for me to say as I'm, that's not true. Anyway, it's a very nervousing section, but it doesn't matter. If you're there in Matthew 19, my remote's not working at all, so I have no idea what to do, guys. Should I try this one? Nope, the white one's not working. Nothing works. This is Eastgate. Anyway, if you're there in Matthew 19, if we can begin with verse 1. And you're not going to see it up there, apparently, so hopefully, wait, is that me or you? That was me. Okay, woohoo! This is the kind of church where we get really excited about small things like technology actually working. It's, you know, one of those things. Welcome. Anyway, now when Jesus had finished, we're in Matthew 19, verse 1. Now when Jesus had finished these sayings, he went away from Galilee and entered the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" And he answered, "Haven't you read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So they're no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." And they said to him, "Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and send her away?" And he said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it wasn't so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. Now are you glad you came today?" Interestingly, here's the thing. Over the... You know, we look at the course of our American culture, and increasingly over the last few decades, Americans have become highly cynical about marriage. And we can see why, because divorce rates, and while the numbers are still a little bit nebulous, the divorce rates still linger close to the 50% range. And those numbers are actually starting to decline, but we can't read too much into that because the number of marriages has decreased dramatically as well, which accounts for the decrease in numbers for divorced couples. More and more Americans are choosing to cohabitate instead of marry, and according to Pew Research Center, of those polled, over 50% responded that they believe society would be just as well off if people just cohabitated and as opposed to marrying. In fact, there's a great deal of debate right now, even in our culture, over the role of marriage in modern day life, whether or not it's like an outmoded or primitive notion that we don't need anymore. Know that over the last few years, the great debate has been over just who has the right to marry and whether or not gender has a role in that. And all of these issues are way too deep and complex for us to really get into this morning. But there's some interesting things that I would like to point out. One of the things that I came across is that several studies have concluded that married couples are less likely to get pneumonia, have surgery, develop cancer, or have heart attacks. That's a curious bit of research that emerged. Now, this is all just based on the numbers of things. Marriage isn't some magical cure for the prevention of these things. It's just that the research, the polling research, indicates that the numbers in those categories are lower for married people. Those studies actually prompted the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to initiate a $150 million project to reduce divorce rates in the United States because of the health benefits associated with marriage. I find that fascinating. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just numbers out there or whatever, but there's something intriguing about that to me underneath it all. So while, you know, it's understandable that our culture has become cynical of marriage because obviously of what has been witnessed in our experiences, actual research being done seems to indicate that there is real benefit to this. And for those of us who embrace the idea of a creator God, of someone who made us and designed this, when we look at that, we can't help but conclude there's design behind all of this. As those who embrace the idea that there's a creator behind all of this, we don't see marriage as an evolutionary convenience that we've somehow grown out of, that we no longer need. We recognize a theology in it, that there is an aspect of God revealing himself in these things. And that brings us to our text today. In the narrative, Jesus has traveled to the region of Judea, and as has typical of his ministry so far, when he gets there, people show up and they're coming to him to be healed. But it tells us the Pharisees came and asked him a question that is described as a test. Their question is meant as an entrapment of some kind. Now, as I covered in the teachings that I mentioned previously, at that point, we have to stop and ask some very serious questions. Why is this a test, for one thing? What's going on in here? We realize right off the bat something about Jesus. Jesus was not roaming the countryside teaching people the rules for divorce. That was not the main emphasis of his ministry. This only comes up as the religious leaders who oppose Jesus present it to him as a trap. Now, why is it a trap? Why? Because of where Jesus is. He's in Judea. That's how this whole thing started. He moved into the region of Judea, which is under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas. And we know who, oh, I hit the wrong button, you guys. I'm so sorry. We know who Herod Antipas is. He is the same guy who had John the Baptist arrested and then executed. Remember that? Does anybody remember why he had John the Baptist arrested? Because what? Because Herod wanted the girl, right? Okay, we just had to qualify that. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Because Herod, John the Baptist publicly opposed Herod's divorce of his wife and his remarriage to his brother Philip's wife, her divorce and their subsequent marriage together, something that the law expressly forbid under the law of Moses. Herod is trying to present himself as the man of Israel, as in messianic terms, and so John the Baptist is calling that into question. And so he had him arrested, summarily executed. This was a politically charged question for the Pharisees to bring to Jesus. And it's likely that the Pharisees were hoping that Jesus would publicly incriminate himself, just like John the Baptist did, and he would then meet the same fate. Their job is done. They can move along with their lives. The question they posed was centered around a fiercely debated topic of divorce at that time among the adherents of two different schools of thought, of rabbinical thought. Those who followed the teachings of Rabbi Hillel and those who followed the teachings of Rabbi Shammai. In Deuteronomy 24, in the law of Moses, it states this about divorce, that when a man takes a wife and marries her, if she then finds no favor in his eyes because He has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, he can send her out of the house, and she's got to leave. Okay, so that was, you know, we look at that, and that seems kind of harsh, but understanding the context, the ancient world, as such as it was, a patriarchal world as it was, that actually was something that was designed to protect women in large degrees. Men couldn't just willy-nilly cast women aside. They actually had to go through a process of dividing from someone. And then there were laws about subsequently what you were supposed to do after that. Something unheard of in the ancient world. But either way, in interpreting that for the time of Jesus, Rabbi Hillel was a guy who looked at that word that is translated, find no favor in his eyes, and he kind of translated that a little bit more liberally. He just said, that means anything. You know, if she burns the toast, or if she gets too old, or he decided she wasn't pretty enough, a guy could divorce her and send her away. As long as he wrote out a certificate of divorce, it was cool. And you know what? The guys liked him. I mean, they just did. And so... along comes another rabbi. Rabbi Shammai, on the other hand, believed that that word used there was limited to infidelity and should apply only to those cases. This was the debate that was raging at that time. But remember, the whole reason it's being brought up is because it's got political ramifications if Jesus weighs in on it publicly. That's, you know, what was happening in Jesus' time was similar to our day. Humans are humans. And the divorce rate was skyrocketing in first century Israel because of Hillel's liberal view about this passage. So men were just casually divorcing their wives and feeling okay about it. There were no repercussions within the church community. There was the synagogue community. There was no repercussions on a social level or even legal level. Men were divorcing their wives at a rapid pace. In fact, as was the case with Herod, it was often when a man saw someone that he wanted more than his wife that he would divorce his first wife so he could take the one that he was desiring. And this, I believe, is what Jesus is getting at in his answer. This casual, flippant approach to the dissolution of a marriage in order to pursue someone else. And that's why I believe he connects this with adultery, because they had twisted the law to become some sort of sanitized, approved form of adultery. Well, you know, I can just do this now. And the underlying point is, God had something else in mind when he provided us with this union of marriage. The Pharisees were looking at marriage as a purely legal issue. What are the contractual obligations of this thing? And what are the loopholes that could get me out of this contract? And Jesus blows past all of that, and he reminds us that marriage is a relational issue. It is not a legal, contractual issue in its origin, at its heart. When God brought humans together into marriage, it was in order to form of a relationship that was so closely united that the two lives become like one life when you think in terms of perspectives and how the road seems far apart at the beginning and how it comes together at the end. That was a concept in this, the two lives. Doesn't mean that we lose our identities, doesn't mean that we lose our personalities, but their purpose, the married couple's purpose is so joined together that it forms this unique entity at work in the world. That's the concept behind it. It's actually an extension of God's creative activity. The union of two lives creates something in the world that hadn't been known before. And if that union creates children, then there's something else that the world hadn't known before. And it's this ongoing creative act on God's part. It's beautiful and it's intimate and it's personal, and it's not meant to be approached like some sort of legal contract, like just another business deal that goes down. Over the long history of modern civilization, we've come to a place today where most governments issue licenses for marriage, and that becomes our standard for establishing a marriage that is legally recognized. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. That's just the way societies have developed. The only thing that would be a problem with that is if we allow the state's involvement in the definition of marriage to begin redefining our understanding of marriage to being that of a legal contract instead of its original intended purpose, and that is a relationship under God. That's the concept of a marriage. The Pharisees of Jesus' day had reduced marriage down to this idea that, you know, is this legal or not? Can I break this or not? Is there a loophole for me to shimmy around in this somehow? And that's why I believe Jesus makes that statement, what God has joined together, let not man separate. In other words, this is between a married couple and God. This isn't something to be dissected by legal scholars. This isn't something to be established in their thinking at all. This is a sacred relationship, and it needs to carry the weight of that. Not just some legal examination, but it's a sacred relationship that carries with it the theological intent that God had for it. And we need to keep that in our understanding of what marriage is all about in this. In fact, that's the other point I believe that Jesus is making in this. That marriage as a sacred relationship is something that is to be protected and something to be worked for. It's not just something that just happens. It's not something that comes as a result of the way Hollywood presents things as people's hormones and emotions guide them to these things. There's something heavy going on here. There's something important going on that we need to pay attention to. Jesus weighs in on the debate between Hillel and Shammai, and he seems to side with Shammai by stating the exception of sexual immorality as a basis for divorce. And as I outline in my previous teachings on this, I don't believe Jesus is narrowly defining a singular exception for the dissolution of a marriage, but he's indicating that he believed Hillel was missing the point in treating this so casually, in turning this into something so flippant. If we're married, God intends for us to work at our marriage, to build it up and to protect it, not to be on the lookout for how we can get out of it or find someone new to move on with. The Pharisees countered in this that, well, Moses, you know, why did Moses command us to go do this? Which is hilarious that this is the way they word that. Well, it's kind of hilarious, kind of not. They say, why did Moses command us to get a certificate of divorce? And Jesus counters that and saying he didn't command anything. No, Moses allowed, but he wasn't commanding anybody to go do this. He allowed this if it tragically happens, but it's not something to treat casually. It's not something we just shrug our shoulders and move along with. The Pharisees seem to think that since the law allowed for it, it meant that God was just as happy to let a divorce happen as he was to see a couple get married. Nah, big deal, no other way. But marriage is a sacred relationship. There's a theology behind it. It's a sacred relationship. He points back to Genesis account, a relationship between a man and a woman and God, and it's a primary way in which the whole image of God is projected into this world. It goes back, as we've talked about before, to original vocation, to what we're made for, to be image bearers of God in this world. And there's ways in which he's presented that, put that together for us. And his clause about sexual immorality gets at the sacredness of this thing. Now, the word that he uses is the Greek word porneia, which is the root word for our English word, you can probably put it together, for pornography. And that word deals with all manner of sexual immorality, from infidelity to incest to pederasty, on and on and on, all the various ways in which we see sexuality expressed in from a Christian or from a biblical perspective in a way that's not as God intended it. Marriage is the sacred place for the expression of our sexuality. That's something that's as clear as can be throughout the biblical record. That's the original intent. And that relationship of marriage is meant to be protected from interlopers, whether that's through infidelity or just through the influence of this broken world's view of sexuality, through the influence of our culture's obsession with sex or with the booming pornography trade or the objectification that our culture falls into of both sexes. Fallen, you know, we can look at it and we can say, oh yeah, this world has gotten so bad. The world has always been bad. Understand that. The world has always had a skewed view of sexuality. It's always twisted away from God's original intent. It does it on everything. It's not just sexuality. This world, a place where we're trying to manufacture heaven without God, it's always skewing things away from what it is that God intended. And our culture right now, as it's been increasingly so ever since the 1960s, is especially preoccupied with sexuality. But through the easy access of pornography to worldviews that see sex as merely biological urges that need to be satisfied, it's nothing more than that, our culture has diminished human sexuality to the point that it is meaningless It is meaningless. That's why we've got a phrase in this popular in our culture. It's just sex. It's just sex. My voice sounds makes me sound really weird to say that. I heard that in my head and I was embarrassed immediately. Makes me want to go home right now. The point is, our culture has dehumanized our sexuality. That's the whole point of this. God's trying to bring us back to our humanity. Our culture treats us like animals. But listen, here's the thing. You know, oh, so today's the day that Rob decided to get up and be a prude. No, Christianity has always been set apart because of our sexual ethic. You realize that. That predates the moral majority by a long shot. The early church, which was established in the midst of a sex-obsessed Roman culture, stood out as abnormal. One of the chief reasons they started suffering persecution is that Christians were no longer participating in the normal things that everybody participated in, which oftentimes dealt with public orgies and things like that, that the Christians no longer tolerated in their own lives. And so they all of a sudden became, you know, objects of suspicion. Well, what's up? What are you guys up to? Why are you trying to spoil everybody's fun? There's a famous letter that was written by an anonymous Christian back in the early 100s who was trying to explain Christianity to his Roman friend. It's called the Letter to Diognetus. It's an excellent letter. You should read it sometime. You can find it online easily. Just look for early church writings. But as he's describing the uniqueness of Christianity, he points out that Christians can't be distinguished from the rest of humanity by our race or our country or our language or anything. But how he does identify Christians is as people who live differently. And he's listing off all the different things that point out how we've found a different way of living. We've found a new place where we find wholeness and meaning and purpose in life. And he gets into this part and he says, I'm quoting here, he says, the Christians marry like everyone else, and they beget children, but they don't cast out their offspring. Remember we talked about that, how in Roman culture, if you had a child that was unwanted, it was common practice just to leave that child out into the elements to be either, suffer from exposure or be eaten by dogs or whatever. So he says, we have children, but this sets them out. They don't cast out their offspring. They share their homes with each other, but not their marriage bed. Something that the Romans did without a second thought. That was just part of their culture. From the very beginning, the church has had a sexual ethic that has distinguished it from the world, from the way this twisted and broken world moves and operates. And one of our roles in marriage is to protect that sacred relationship from that skewed influence of this broken world. We have to recognize marriage as an important relationship. Something important, not just because it is an underlying institution that holds society together. Certainly the Romans even knew that. But it's beyond even that. There's a theology to this. There's something that God wants to express through our lives joined together. It's important. It's something to pay attention to. It's something, no matter how much the world tries to devalue it, it's something that we need to protect and to look after. Okay, so anyway, so Jesus, obviously responds with a lot more than the Pharisees were expecting to hear, and it gave everyone a lot to think about. You know, classic Jedi Messiah trick Jesus pulls here. You know, they try to trap him, they put him in the corner here with a politically charged question. He asks questions back, and then the whole thing just kind of gets diffused because there's nowhere they can go with it, but everybody's having to think about it. And so the disciples then, as they're thinking about it, get to verse 10. The disciples said to him, if such is the case with a man, with his wife, it's better not to marry. Wow. Okay. So right off the bat, we see from their side, this sounds like a lot more work than I thought it was going to be. Maybe we should just bail on this. But he said to them, look, not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it's given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. But the one who's able to receive this, receive it. Well, now this is a really odd little passage here in Matthew's gospel. And it's unique to Matthew's gospel in this whole thing. People have wondered for many years how this Jewish rabbi is talking so easily about eunuchs when eunuchs were highly offensive to Jewish culture and thought. And he's just talking away about it like, you know, everybody understands. I don't know. Did the disciples even understand what he was talking about in this? I don't know. And listen, what is he talking about, Rob? I don't know. I'm going to tell you right now, there is no consensus on this. This is one of those things. There's all these different viewpoints, all these different ideas of what he's saying. I could go into all the aspects of it, but it's not going to resolve onto anything where I'm going to say, there you go. Now you know what he's talking about, because I'm not sure. It is really hard to say if he's talking metaphorically, literally. The point, though, that he's making is pretty straightforward. In answer to the disciples' question about whether or not it's better to marry, Jesus basically says that singleness is not a curse, and for some, it may be a gift. And that's something, actually, that we have to pay attention to. I think we don't take enough time to look at this passage often. You know, even though the numbers in marriages in our culture are in the decline, there's still a cultural stigma that's associated with singleness. You realize that. There's still a certain level of stigma that that a person has to endure if they find themselves in a single state. And yet here is Jesus talking to a family-oriented Jewish people who saw marriage and having children as a solemn responsibility and who definitely stigmatized those who were single. And he just explodes that whole prejudice by affirming the value of the single individual, affirming the value of a person who finds themselves single. And he's making it very clear, something that applies to all of us, whatever our relational state is, that dignity and personhood do not come from marriage and offspring, but from identity in God's kingdom. And he says there, even some people will choose singleness for the sake of God's kingdom, because that's the source of our identity. That's the source of our wholeness, not our relational status. And he makes it equally clear in this that not everyone's going to be able to do this. But if a person is single, it's important to know that that's nothing to be ashamed of. If a person is single, that's all right. That's a time to know you're right where God has you for the time being, or has you, just to be able to be all right with that. You know, later on, Paul presents as a viable Christian experience, singleness, as profitable to the Christian life. You can look at what he says there in 1 Corinthians 7. But again, he qualified. That's not going to be for everybody. Not everybody's going to be able to do something like this. John the Baptist does not appear to have married at any point. Jesus, of course, was not married, unless you ask Dan Brown. Paul seems to... I was going to say it's a literary joke, but I'm not going to qualify that as literature. Anyway, Paul... And now you know my opinion about books out there. Paul seems to have foregone marriage in order to pursue what was more important and urgent in his calling. The missionary Amy Carmichael never married. Of course, we know Mother Teresa never married. These are people who were highly effectual, prized, that go down through history as people that are very, very important, not only to us as individuals, but as the church. So the thing is, we have to remember, singleness is not a curse. Never, ever see it as that. Being single should never be a stigma in our understanding, if that's our state or if we're observing someone else. Our value is determined by God's love for us and not our relational status. Never that. It's always our relationship with God that defines who we are. And I just really like, I don't know, I just like that these concepts are placed here side by side in this text. You know, there's a tendency sometimes to split these things up and you know, focus so much on the one side of this and lose the reality of the affirmation that Jesus is providing to the single individual. And bottom line is, whether we're single or married, we have value and purpose, and God's grace overshadows all of that. He's the one whose love now defines us. He's the one who gives us our meaning, our value, our purpose in this world. So, if we're married, let's see our marriage as a sacred relationship. Let's work at it. Let's protect it. Let's do our part to see to it that the theology of that is rightly represented in this world. If we're divorced, let's not see that as an impetus from moving forward impediment to moving forward, rather, but let's put that in God's hands. Let's find hope in the new horizons that he always provides for us. If we're single, let's not be bullied by our culture. Let's not allow that to be something that's negative in our experience. Let's find our value in God's great love for us and find the fullness that he wants for us in our lives, where, whatever our state is, to live in his fullness in whatever we do. Let's allow God to define our humanity, not the culture, not the government, not any other influence. Let's allow God to define who we are as human beings under him. And maybe we'll find our wholeness in that. Right on? All right, very cool. Before you stand up, because normally I say, will you stand up with me? I just want to run a few things by you. And I just figured this will get your mind off of anything if I said something offensive along the way here. So, but some things have changed in terms of our leadership board here. And I just want to make you aware of that. We don't, you know, this isn't a congregationally run church or anything like that, but we're a community. As a board, we prayed about different members that needed to come on board with us. And so I want you to be aware of who all's on the board here now. Lance and Liz Livingston are on the board. Mike and Darby Brown are on the board. The guy on the far right is on the board. And then we've just recently added Kevin and Stephanie Barron on as our treasurers. And so they're going to be part of these decision-making processes. They've been working with Robbie before on Dave Ramsey's financial wholeness group meetings and stuff. What we do on this is that I'm presenting this to you. Pray about it with us. If anybody has things that they want to discuss about that, let's discuss it. Let's talk about it or whatever. But just so you know, this is who the board is. What does the board do, Rob? Well, the board is basically just a group of people that get together to pray about what it is in terms of what it is that we need to do in making major decisions for the church. And we're not talking about like major, major decisions, because I'm going to get to that. But, you know, things in terms of, you know, how salaries are set or whatever. I mean, just, you know, what kinds of equipments that we can use or things like that. We get together, we pray about these things. We don't vote in the board. We pray about it. If the Lord gives us unity and we feel like we're on board together, then we move forward and we make decisions based on that. So, these are the people. Look around for him. Mike is back there at the soundboard right now, but he's got headphones on. He may not even be able to hear me, but yeah, he's back. He waved. Liz actually is right back there underneath the info hub. You can go talk to her. Her husband, Lance, is an ex-cop who's walking around here waiting to beat somebody up at some point. I'm just kidding. Lance is the sweetest, most wonderful person I know. Anyway, so I just want you to be aware of who the board is. And there's one more thing that I want to present to you, and that is the state of our building. We are fast approaching a place where this building is falling into such a state of disrepair that we're not exactly sure, you know, what to do next. We've talked with the landlord, not directly, but with the agent who works under the landlord. The landlord doesn't seem to be interested in making any changes or affecting any of the repairs that need to be affected, such as a leaky roof, which I'm sure you've come in here plenty of times before and seen the buckets around this place, which just makes for such a lovely atmosphere. But anyway, you know, it is what it is. There's no viable options for us at this point, but I'm making you aware of it because as a church community, it's something we need to be praying about. You know, pray about it, see how the Lord leads us, you know, get dialogues started or whatever. I mean, if one thing we could be praying, which would be my solution, is for the Lord to move on the owners to fix the roof, and we can just, you know, make some of the other repairs that need to be made because of that. But either way, just so you're aware of where we're at, if you're visiting here today, you're thinking, is he going to stop? And I will, I promise. But so you know. So why don't you stand up with me and just so that you're in the loop and you're aware of what's going on. This morning, it's the last Sunday of the month, and so what we want to be able to do is pray for those who may be sick. So if there are, if you're here this morning and you would like to be prayed for healing, we believe that this is part of what the church is about, that as the kingdom of God, we're here to advance his goodness, and part of his healing rule is healing. Now, we're not a name it, claim it kind of group of people or anything, so we're not guaranteeing anything, but we're saying that we're going to pray, and we can guarantee that God will hear our prayers. And so there'll be those of us, Dr. Dave, Shirley, I'm sure Jeannie's around here somewhere. We'll pray with you, anoint you with oil if you'd like. But other than that, let's pray this prayer together before we dismiss from here today. Our Father in heaven, reveal who you are. Set the world right. Do your will here like it's done in heaven. Provide for our daily needs. Keep us forgiven with you and forgiving others. Keep us safe from ourselves and the devil. We confess you're in charge. You're our provider. Our lives are in your hands. Yes and amen. Go in peace, you children of God.